Hi, this is Iking Reyes, and you're on The Inspiring Leader. It's a podcast where we talk about things and stuff about life, love, and learning. On this episode, we are joined by Dr. Ben Tihanki. He's a business ethics professor, management educator, newspaper columnist, and consultant to various organizations. Dr. Tihanki, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Iking. Great to hear from you. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to be part of your podcast.
Being a professor of business ethics, what is the place now of business ethics in the digital world?
Yeah, great question. Well, basically, business ethics is just promoting doing what's right in the realm of business. And as we know, a lot of business has moved digitally. This is even before the pandemic, right? We've heard of the fourth industrial revolution where everything, you know, will be mediated by networks, robotics, artificial intelligence. But, you know, with the pandemic, everything has accelerated. So we were thrown into digital transformation by force. Therefore, the challenge now is how do you make sure that business that we do over the internet is ethical, morally defensible? Because now everything is very impersonal. We do it by looking at each other through screens in computers, right? So you don't even deal with each other face to face anymore. No handshakes. This was the usual things that you would use to test whether a person is sincere. You can look him in the eye, shake his hands. All of that is gone. So I would say that in the digital realm of business, ethics is now even more important. It's absolutely vital now.
Sir, we've dealt with the pandemic and it's still going on. What is the social responsibility of businesses, especially big businesses, in this time?
A big business has always had a major responsibility in our country, which is to be the distributor of wealth and well-being. Because every time a business registers with the government, the understanding is the business will be a partner of the government in, you know, socioeconomic development. That's called the social contract. However, in our country, unfortunately, big business has turned out to be more of a concentrator of wealth. It has become a huge mechanism for extracting value created by millions of ordinary people and concentrating this in the hands of very few. Now, this is a structural issue. I think I always like to use the analogy of a buffet. In a buffet, everybody has the same right as anybody else to go to the buffet table and get their share, right? But, you know, even in a buffet, some tables are closer to the buffet table. So, but ideally, government or the manager of the buffet will make sure that even the farthest table has food. In our country, many of the big businesses are very close to the buffet table. And the tendency is they tend to concentrate a lot of the benefits of the economy. So I think, in general, the role of corporations and big business was supposed to be distributing the benefits of capitalism to everyone. It's like a cell site, if you can use that analogy. But now, because the pandemic has made the inequality even more painful for so many people, that role of big business as a distributor of the benefits of capitalism is now even more intensely needed. It has to work double time because the pain and misery is just so great that a lot of the resources to cope with the pandemic is in the hands of the biggest companies because they have the reserves, they have the assets, obviously, they have the IT infrastructure. So I think they really need to step up. And, you know, to be fair, many big businesses have stepped up since the quarantine, but they need to do this in a continuing, mindful, and sustained basis.
I understand, sir, that you're also a member of the PHAP Ethics Board, so which is the Pharmaceutical Healthcare Association of the Philippines. Just as a side question, what would be your thoughts on the ethical implications of the advanced vaccination of some members of the government?
Are you referring to the PSG and some reported military
Yes.
beneficiaries? I have two thoughts. One is, with respect to the president, I believe that the president should take every reasonable step to protect himself. We are in a pandemic. I don't think we can afford to have a sick president at this time. We've seen what happened to the US, France, and the UK, where their leaders got the infection. And I don't think we have the stability to withstand that kind of political shock, right? So I think it's reasonable for the president to seek some level of protection. That's only prudent, if you ask me. However, it creates a real challenge in public communication. It has to be communicated very well that we are in an emergency. Obviously, our president is not doing what Putin did, you know, to lock himself in where nobody can actually even interact with him. But certainly the idea is the same. You have to, the head of state needs to be stable. The challenge is really public communication, because we're in a highly politicized environment where even what I think is reasonable can be misinterpreted as insensitive. So I think that being said, I think it doesn't help that different officials are giving different explanations. No? So not only is there no effective communication, there's actual confusion. So yeah, in summary, I think it's a reasonable step for the president to seek protection by having vaccination for those who are close to him physically. But I think that should have come with very effective public communication. And I think people would have understood. But if you get very mixed messages in a highly politicized environment, it raises issues of trustworthiness, I would say. So, but per se, I don't think it's a problem for me. It's just that it has to be handled sensitively, I would say.
For the next remaining questions, I'd like to focus on you. You've been in the academe for several decades, I would say. I'm interested on where did the passion started? So where did the inspiration come from? And how were you able to motivate yourself and stay on top of this game for the longest time?
Well, first of all, I got my start completely by accident. I had a teacher in sociology, and I was such an interested student in sociology. I would always be two chapters ahead. And then one time, my teacher, her name was Jennifer Lobby. She is American. She invited me to the office and she said, "Would you like to teach?" And this was freshman year. And then I asked, "What do you mean?" "Well, we have a scholarship program. If you are accepted in the scholarship program, when you graduate, you get to teach." And then I asked, "What does it mean?" "Well, you get an allowance. You also get free books." And, you know, she had me at free books. So I said, "Why not?" So it wasn't like a very deliberate decision on my part. I kind of stumbled into it because I was offered free books. So therefore, when I started teaching in 1983, shortly after Ninoy Aquino was shot, I never really looked back. Basically, I like reading. I like knowing new stuff. And I like talking about stuff. And I like being with people who are also interested in learning. So in other words, I can talk in front of people for free, but they gave me a job and I get paid to do this. Wow, I told myself, wow, this is it. I can do this all night without tiring. In other words, I've never seen teaching as a job. For me, it's a calling, it's a vocation. I think young people need help in making sense of the world and finding their place in the world. People have done that for me, and I think that's a service I like to do for young people as well. And so I would say I found my calling. I never really seriously considered leaving academia, even though there have been lows as much as highs. You know, like you prepare so much for your lesson and your syllabi, and you realize your students don't even read. And so I lose my temper sometimes, but then I talk to them one-on-one and say, "Hey, you know, you can do better than this." So sometimes you just have to go out of your way to motivate people to study. But for me, it's always been a good fit. It's been a great source of fulfillment for me, I must say. I'm lucky. I'm not sure if it was Socrates. It was some Greek philosopher who said, "Find work you love and you never have to work a day in your life." I think that applied to me. And what can I say? It's been almost 40 years and I can do this for another 10, 15 years, if allowed. Why not?
Sir, I'm interested to know more about your current ukulele game. Because in one of the conversations we had before, you were trying to learn the ukulele.
Oh, I have some skill. You want me to play something for you?
Yeah, sure, sir.
Give me a sec. Okay, I have here my tenor ukulele. So I got this when I was in LA to visit my brother. So let's have a short piece that I'm sure you're familiar with.
I'm glad I asked. I'm jealous now. I'm jealous. How long did it take you to learn that piece?
This one was a week, I think. I just played the chords. I usually play standards like this. Try to guess this one.
Johnny Mathis.
Yeah, that's there are lots of YouTube tabs that you can follow.
Speaking of YouTube, sir, actually, that's my next question. Because you learned playing the ukulele via YouTube. No, at least initially, that's what you told me. So, but you could learn almost anything from YouTube. Almost everything, like my Excel, I built my Excel knowledge out of YouTube. But what, as an academician, as a teacher, no, as a trainer, what would be your tip to a regular person when they want to learn through YouTube?
Well, if you're passionate about something, you really want to learn, but human teachers can be impatient. So the nice thing about YouTube is it doesn't get tired repeating, right? And then you can make it repeat, you can slow it down. So I would say look for a YouTube teacher that fits your style, because there are so many online. And then experiment with how well this teaching style works for you. For example, in the ukulele, I've followed different teachers. Not all of them work well for me. Some have a better way of explaining. Some can bring it down to your level, while some are very advanced. So I think it's a matter of fit in terms of what works for you, and then the pace. And for me, the most important thing is it has to be fun, because when you're learning a new skill, of course, it can be frustrating sometimes. But if the YouTube expert makes it fun, you know, before you know it, you're growing in skill, and that's really a source of joy, source of affirmation. I also learned playing drums digitally, although I used a software. So I learned to play drums such that we have a band. I play the drums in the band in a couple of months. I think there is just no limit to what can be learned digitally, but you really have to be very discerning on choosing the right one. Because let's face it, Iking, there's also a lot of garbage out there. You can learn as much malpractice as good practice. And so if you choose the wrong teacher, you will acquire many, many bad habits that will be difficult to unlearn. So shop around, look for a good teacher that has a credible approach. Read the comments before you really lock in on your chosen YouTube teacher. That's what I would advise.
So speaking of teaching, how do you think should teachers in general, should prepare or even adapt to the online learning, which is currently the norm?
I started by saying that we have been all shoved into digital transformation, right? So many of us were really not ready. And for me, for example, I'm a very social person. If I see you face to face, you know, I would approach you. We would have a lot of laughs. I'd probably pat you in the shoulder and ask you, how have you been? So all of that I cannot do through a Zoom screen. And that's really difficult for me. I feel like a paraplegic in a way. But the way I deal with that is I try to get some background information on all the students. For example, when I start my classes, I give a survey on where they are located, and then I make a map so I can see where they are. For example, in a typical undergraduate class now, I have a map of where my students are. So maybe I'll have a few in Lawag, in Tarlac. I have some in the Visayas, maybe a couple in Mindanao. Most of them would be in Metro Manila. So at least I have a sense of where they are. And then I also ask them in the survey to do a speed test, so I know their bandwidth and their speed. Because sometimes you take it for granted that everybody is having the same experience as you, and that's really dangerous. And then I make sure to put in some background personal questions. What are your hobbies, interests? How do you like to learn? What are your fears about learning online? So all of this I review as part of my profile of my students, so to speak. So I make them feel that I'm interested in them as individual persons. Why is this? Because, you know, when you try to engage people, my philosophy is I'm like a middleman, or maybe a matchmaker. Let's put it that. My goal is to form a love affair between my students and my subject matter, because they don't really care about my subject matter. But if I can show that I care for them, then they will reciprocate, and this is my theory, by being more caring about the subject. So it's a long shot, but you know, for me, it pays off. So if I see a student who's not engaged, I reach out to the person. I look at the person's profile and I try to connect to that person's interest. And I say, okay, I know you're in banking, and does this make sense to you? And suddenly that person begins to glow, you know, because you're tapping into the person's background. You're now linking it to something that's dear to him or her. So I think this can be done online in ways that wasn't easy to do before. Because obviously in a face-to-face class, it's more difficult to do a paper survey, right? Or to do a Google map where you can see everybody's location. But now you have all the tools. And so you can easily search the student's profile as you're talking. And then you can right away see the profile of the student here on your other screen. And then say, okay, Iking, since you've been in pharmaceutical in the industry for so many years, what's your take on this? And that's a very good way of drawing learners in, tying it to their background, doing teaching in a very relational manner, and using what seems to be a limitation, which is the computer in the middle of you, to be actually a strength if you deploy it strategically, if you use it in a way that you can data mine a student database, profile them. So that for me, I think, is what has helped me. It will never be the same for me because I really like human contact. But since we're here, we might as well use the digital tools to really, in a way, even be more deeply connected with students. That was possible than before. And paradoxically, I think it is possible that in digital teaching, you're actually more connected to students. But the jury is out on that. I'm still asking myself, is this real, my relationship with students? Because it's 4 months of just looking at each other through little squares on a screen. Is this real? But it feels real. So, but you know, virtual used to mean parang eh, di ba? Yung kunyari, virtual. But I want it to be real, meaning that students will really get to love the subject even though you only taught them through a computer screen. And to do that, I think having that connection with them as humans, for me, is what makes teaching pleasurable. So you transfer the passion through that relationship.
Sir Ben, for my last question, I wanted to know about a current project you're working on, maybe a book. What's occupying your time right now?
I'm a member of the Management Association of the Philippines, and we just launched this campaign we have, the Covenant for Shared Prosperity. And what part of our goal, and this is supported by about 26 business organizations, the biggest business organizations, in fact. So we're really telling businesses to join us in this campaign to reset the economy. When we say reset, to allow the pandemic to give us a second chance at building a better society where more people have opportunities. And as I mentioned earlier, the key here is businesses sharing. And I think one of the main ways of doing this is through what I call humanistic management. Humanistic management is really what I'm writing my book on, no? Humanistic management. And it essentially means managing so that the well-being of people is promoted. Because traditionally, when I ask my students, so what's the main objective of business? They all rush to say, sir, it's profit. And I say, okay, yeah, that's one objective. But is that really the purpose of business? Like, if you say, well, if a business doesn't make profit, it will die, sure. If a person doesn't eat, the person will die, sure. But do we say that a person's purpose is to eat? We don't, right? So of course, a business has to be profitable, but it has to have a purpose higher than that. So humanistic management is really promoting human well-being. this is implemented in multiple ways. When we deliver products and services, we ask ourselves, are these really good for people? Will they really help the quality of life of people? That's very important. We have a lot of products that are downright harmful to people. And, you know, even in the digital realm, streaming services, gaming, is leading to a lot of online addiction like we've never seen before. The challenge to online businesses is how to give the good but minimize the bad. So that's on the customer side. On the employee side, it's very important that work is seen less as being toxic, the source of stress, even heart attacks, right? Or a lack of family work-life balance. But rather, work under a humanistic manager is seen as an inspiration to serve society through the products and services. It's seen as a way to form friendships in the workplace, lasting friendships. It's a way to get employees to share their ideas and see their ideas become reality. And they can point to say, hey, that policy was part of my suggestion. That's why I'm committed to this company because my ideas are listened to. In this approach to management, it's less about the bottom line. It's less about the efficiency. It's even less about merely productivity. But it's more of everybody growing as human beings, where we use the economics of business, the profit, the sales, the revenue, merely as a means, just like we use food as a means, right? We don't live to eat. We eat to live. Businesses do not make profit to exist. It uses profit to continue doing what it needs to do, which is its mission, which is to uplift the lives of everyone. So I'm really passionate about this. I think for the longest time, management has always been about achieving objectives through people, right? That's what we learn. But, you know, people are not things, so we cannot really use people as tools. In humanistic management, it's more appropriate to say we achieve goals for people, not through people, for people. When you give work to a subordinate, you want the work to help that subordinate grow as a person. That's why it's important that the subordinate understands why he has to do it. He has a share in improving the way it's done. He is compensated properly for it, and so on and so forth. No? Customers. And the same applies to all other stakeholders of business. Suppliers need to be treated well as well. The community as whole. Of course, the environment has to be taken care of. So all of this is part of humanistic management, making sure that business and organizing is an uplifting experience for everyone. So I'm giving myself, knock on wood, maybe up to my 40th birthday, 40th anniversary in teaching to publish this, which will be in a couple of years. But if I'm lucky, because of the pandemic, I might be able to finish my first draft by next year. And hopefully that will be the focus of my personal advocacy moving forward, to really drum up this approach to management, which is more about uplifting people and promoting well-being.
Before I end the podcast, I would like to ask for more words of encouragement from you for those listeners out there who would want to make their own mark in the world. What would be your advice to them?
Yeah, I really believe that each of us has a gift that we need to share with others. We need to find that gift. We need to really deeply reflect what is it that we want to share. The challenge now is because of social media, there is a very strong pressure to be homogeneous. We keep comparing ourselves with others, right? And so when we are not like others, we feel less. But actually, it should be the other way around. I think what social media should remind us is how to celebrate how different we all are and how we can be different and still be okay. So if we really think deeply about our passions, what turns us on, so to speak, there's something there. And I like to compare it to I think it's Chapman's model of the languages of love. I don't know if you're familiar with that. He says we have different languages of love, how we express love. Some do it through service, some do it by spending time, some do it by sharing words, some do it by giving gifts, and so on. I think each of us have different ways of sharing love. So our passion for something should be converted to something that we share as love. Because if we do something with passion and love, it will really leave a mark, whatever it is. Because people are always in need of inspiration. And when they see other people fulfilling their destiny, following their passions, then they say, oh, I have to find my passion too. And this is what well-being is really all about, which goes back to what I was saying about humanistic management. If we are a good humanistic manager, we enable everyone to find their passion and convert that to a day-to-day reality. So let's make our passions a day-to-day reality. Let's make it connect with the rest of our lives. And just like that famous Greek philosopher, we'll never have to work a day in our lives, but we will always have fun and feel fulfilled.
That's it for today. Let me know what you think. Send in some questions and perhaps share this episode with people you know who might be interested to listen. Till the next episode. Cheers.